Doesn't matter what you're going through, whether it's a good time or a bad time, at some point everything will pass and that will change.
Die Schweiz umfasst 220 Kilometer vom Norden in den Süden und 348 Kilometer von Ost nach West. Das macht, wer gut in der Schule war und aufgepasst hat, 568 Kilometer. Aber Nima hat 627 Kilometer hinter sich gebracht, zu Fuß, und hat dabei nicht einmal die Stadt Zürich verlassen. Und zwar vom 21. August bis zum 31. August, über 10 Tage, hat er den Everesting World Record neu definiert, in neue Höhen gehoben. Passt gut, in Höhen gehoben. Er hat nämlich dabei 148 Mal den Ütli bestiegen und wieder runter und wieder hoch. Dabei 55.000 Höhenmeter gemacht, mit wie gesagt 627 Kilometern insgesamt. Der ursprüngliche Weltrekord war 42.000 Höhenmeter und er hat ihn auf 55.000 hochgeschraubt, wie gesagt. Und Top 6 Mal Backyard Ultra Gewinner, Tour Tour 500 Kilometer Gewinner, Race Across Switzerland 500 Kilometer Gewinner. Unglaubliche Leistungen. Wer ist eigentlich dieser Nima? Nima ist knapp 42 Jahre alt. Er kommt aus Nord-London. Er arbeitet im Financial Management, lebt seit 10 Jahren in der Schweiz. Wir kennen ihn durch den Wittiger Backyard, durch diverse Events am Uetliberg, als einen sehr lebenslustigen, aber auch sehr fokussierten Menschen. Er liebt das Velofahren und, jetzt kommt's, Zitat, I hate running.
Aber wenn das mal nicht spannende Zutaten sind für ein absolut tolles und wirklich unterhaltsames Interview, das wir mit Nima aufgenommen haben. In englischer Sprache, müssen wir dazu sagen.
Really?
Really? Oh, man. Und darin haben wir unter anderem mit ihm gesprochen, wie er eben mit diesen Herausforderungen und diesen wahnsinnigen Leistungen umgeht, also dass er die überhaupt erzielen kann. Welche Strategien er hat, um diese Ziele zu erreichen und wie er auch mit Scheitern umgeht, wenn es denn mal soweit sein sollte. In diesem Sinne, herzlich willkommen bei den Trail Rookies bei der Episode 53 und viel Spaß bei dem Interview mit Nima.
Mats ab.
So, Nima, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for your invitation today. We are very happy, Chris and me, to have the opportunity to talk to you today and to talk with you about several things. We'll come to this later. And we had a great lunch up front.
Yeah, thank you very much for the spaghetti and the salad.
It was quite filling, though. I hope you don't fall asleep during the podcast.
No, perfect.
I feel like energized now, so I have the second coffee now. That's probably the reason why I'm feeling so pushed. No, I'm thrilled to be here, actually, because it's the first time I meet you without sports clothes, actually. Because the last time when I met you, you were on your last laps on the Uetliberg. And we talk about this later. Mm-hmm. Now, before we get into everything, I really want to know, how did you get into sports? That's my first question to you. So how did you get to sports? And yeah, we continue like that, but just the first question, how did you get into sports?
So I've never really been particularly good at any sport in particular. So from a young age, I always did sports, but all sports. So table tennis, badminton, basketball, football, none of it I was very good at. But I think the turning point for me was my first triathlon. I was living in Frankfurt back in 2014, or 2012 actually. And my first triathlon was, I decided that it sounds like it's cool to do, and it was an Ironman.
Okay.
The first time I ever actually participated in a triathlon was an Ironman. 2 years prior to that, I did my first marathon. But there was no progression. It wasn't like I went from Olympic to sprints and then half Ironman or 10K, 21K, then a marathon. Yeah. It was probably the wrong way to do all of these events, which was going all in. But the intent was really just to finish. Okay. So there was no really...
But what was the point? Where did you say, I want to attend a marathon? I want to attend...
I think during that time, maybe it's a natural progression when you move away from going to the gym and you start giving running a go, and then you get a gift as a watch, as a sports watch. Mm-hmm. And back then it was a Polar sports watch. It had no GPS. It had a start stop. That's all it was.
Okay.
And I had a 3 kilometer lake near where I lived in Frankfurt. And all I would do, I would run 3 kilometers.
Okay.
From 3 kilometers, it extended to 5 kilometers. From 5, it went to 10, but I actually couldn't finish the 10. So I got to 7, and I got the bus back.
Okay.
Because my legs just couldn't take me to 10 kilometers.
Oh, really?
I actually couldn't run 10 kilometers.
Okay.
When I did my first marathon in Frankfurt, I think it took me nearly 6 hours. So there was no really... The idea when I started was really... It was, let's just go and have fun. Let's go and finish.
Okay.
It's only in the recent years has that kind of moved from... I want to participate to I actually want to compete.
Okay.
And the competing aspect of it is always when I tell people is it's a very different mindset to actually go and participate to I actually want to go and I want a podium or I want to win it.
Yeah.
Very different.
Very different. But you said you did try a lot of sports. Actually, I guess in school. This was
correct.
In school. So the problem everyone has in school, you need to do sports and probably things you don't like playing basketball, football, stuff like that. But then you went to running. But running is completely different. It's endurance sports. Mm-hmm. And I guess, that's why we are here, because of endurance sports. So what was this step into endurance sports?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I moved to Switzerland in Geneva in December 2014. I joined a running club. They would run 8 kilometers every Monday as a group, and I joined them 3 or 4 times. One of those sessions, the organizer said that they have a spare ticket for Eiger 51.
Ah, okay.
And it was Eiger 51 starting the same, it was in, I think, July or August 2015. Or was it 2016? I can't remember. So I put my hand up and I took the ticket.
Just like that?
Just like that. I put my hand up.
Did you have any idea about the Eiger?
I didn't even know what a trail running shoe was.
Oh, right. You didn't know the Eiger. You didn't know the area.
No, in my head, I thought the longest anyone can ever run is 42 kilometers is a marathon.
It's
that
a marathon.
Was my head. That, yeah. That's all I had in my head. So I went home and I Googled, what is an ultra marathon, an ultra trail run?
After you got the ticket.
After I bought the ticket, exactly. And I realized that it's a whole new world. You know, you have poles and you have trail running shoes and you have lugs and there's hard ground, soft ground, backpack, flask. Nutrition, wow, what's all of this? Oh, you need a life blanket, emergency blanket. Like, it opened up a whole new avenue for me. So I did Eiger 51. I can't remember if it took me, I think, maybe 12 or 14 hours. Again, just to finish, just for fun. I had blisters, I was in terrible shape. But I was like, this was fun. And Eiger, for me, was probably one of my best trail runs, just because the support that Eiger gives you in... especially when you come at kilometer 42, there's watermelon, the weather's good, everyone's it's just a good atmosphere, the music is amazing.
I know 100% what you mean, yeah.
You understand that, right? And then after Eiger 51, I did that same year, and this was when I felt I'd moved from participating to competing. So when I participated in an event to finish, in a year I could have probably done 20 races.
Yeah.
15, 20 races. So I did 50K, 70K, no bike races at this point. A Humani trail, then I did UTMB, CCC, and it progresses. So after I did CCC, I think it was 101, then I did UTMB because I had the point then. And I thought, oh wow, Tour de Gion, that's going from 170 kilometers with 8,000 meters of climbing, or 10 for UTMB, to 330 kilometers and 30,000 meters of climbing. I mean, it took me 144 hours to complete. The winner does it in 77 or 72. So it's a natural progression to see how far can you go, what can you do, how does the body respond, and you learn along the way.
Was that what drove you, actually, this question? What was that the question behind everything? Like, how far can I go? What is my body capable of?
Is there a limit?
Is there a
limit?
Maybe
the limit. And I think I say that, and that's actually a good point, because it's only through the longer distances start to get to know how you are and what's... I don't want to get philosophical into the meaning of life and the rest of it, but I find the first two or three days you spend really just focusing about, I want to say BS, work and errands and just irrelevant topics. Yeah. And it's only after day three or day four, or after you reach 150 kilometers, that you actually become, how can I say, one with nature. You see a sunrise, you see a sunset, and you see the mountains, and you move and you flow, and it's just nice. And I think UTMB versus Tour de Gion, and I think Tour de Gion changes you a little bit. That's what I always say. Anyone that does Tour de Gion, it changes the fabric of who you are. With UTMB, it's still a race, and you see it, and there's always people around. Yeah. Whereas Tour de Gion, because it's so long, you literally you have people walking.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of a pilgrimage.
Okay, I understand. So yeah.
You know the feeling from the 250 Eiger, it's the same topic.
There's no difference.
It's a complete different kind of race, and also you have to say you feel the nature in a complete different way because you have the time.
Correct.
You're not pushing all the time at your limit because you have a lot of time in nature out there.
Yeah, you realize that the mountains are actually alive.
Yeah. And you did that in 1 year. Sorry, did I get it?
Yeah, right? So I think wow. That I went from after the Eiger, I probably did maybe 15 or 20 other races in the UK. I did a 100 miler, which at the time I think was called it was a point to point in Cornwall, Arc of Attrition. It was a 100 miler. I think it was 120 people that started, only 18 finished. There was floods.
18.
Yeah, I was number 18.
Okay.
And the idea was to finish, and I finished, and I was completely broken after that. But and that probably goes by also by the maybe this is also a kind of a good turning point, which is my Instagram hashtag Nima Finisher.
That's what I just wanted to ask you, because you have your Instagram hashtag, right? Correct. Which is called Nima Finisher.
Correct.
So that's
that came because the reason that came was because every race I ever entered, I finished, but I was always last. So I did whatever, if it was CCC, Humani Trail, if the cutoff was 48 hours, I came in at 47. Mm-hmm. I was the last one. As soon as I came in, they pulled the air out and everything just collapses. So I always finished. I never DNF'd until I started to move in the world of Backyard Ultra, where
DNF is part of the game.
Not that you want it to be, but that's when DNF actually... So I've never DNF'd at any event that I've participated. And I've always finished it, but I'm not a trail runner. I mean, after I did all the UTMB, Tour de Gion was my last big race, last big trail race. And after that, I don't trail run anymore.
Okay.
Can I ask a question? Because what I now learned is that you have a quite strong mind, and you set your goals, and then you try really hard to push to get these goals. And your goal was to finish in the beginning. And you also said you were not in the shape to compete for podium at that time. It was really like, I need to go through that, and I want to finish, and you achieved that. Mm-hmm. And then there was a point where you changed your mindset, because you said, now I want to compete for the win.
Yeah.
What was this trigger point?
Yeah.
When did this happen? Or can you tell something
Absolutely.
More about
it? So I think it comes down to you realize, how can I say, what you're good at and what you're not.
Okay.
I'm not a good trail runner.
Okay.
The same way I cycle a lot, but I'm not maybe a good cyclist, depending on how you look at it. So I'll give you an example. I'm scared of descents when trail running. I don't know how to descend at 12 to 15 kilometers an hour. I'm super nervous of twisting my ankle. The same way going up, my body type is not designed to go up like how these other people fly up the mountain. So where that mindset shifted was in 2020, I think it was just after COVID, well, maybe 2021, was when I was on a waiting list ticket for the Whitaker Backyard Ultra. And Carsten Drillin, who's the organizer, a week before the event, sent me a message and said, look, a waiting list ticket has opened. Do you want it? So I said, sounds good. How difficult can it be to run 6.7 kilometers? Didn't realize how long, you know, the logistics around it. So I went there with a backpack, and that was it. I even borrowed a chair from him. run 34 hours and was lucky enough to win it. 34 hours of running. I think it was 232 kilometers or something. And I thought that was cool. Body hurts, but it sounds like it was good. It was at that point that I then signed up for the same year, and I did Jägermeister in September, and I ran 51 hours and broke the Swiss record at the time. And I thought, okay, this is interesting. Maybe this is kind of what I'm good at.
So it was a format that fits you and your capabilities.
A format that fits me, but I don't like running. And for those that are close to me would know, I hate running, and that's probably where this becomes even more interesting. I love cycling, and I love cycling extremely long distances. So for me, the perfect cycle is going around Zurichsee twice on a Sunday and doing 200 kilometers. That's heaven for me. Like, I love doing that. Mm-hmm. So it's not so much the sport, it's the endurance. So even if I was to, I'm not a good swimmer, but if there's a challenge to run, to swim 90 kilometers around Zurichsee, I would do it. Mm-hmm. Because that's what interests me. What interests me is the endurance aspect, to just really going far. Okay. And also, I feel I'm good at it. So I know that when I'm hurting, I also know that everyone else behind me or in front of me is also hurting.
At one point.
At one point, we're all hurting.
Yeah. Well, can I quick ask a question? Because you said, I just need to go back a little bit, mm-hmm. because you said you were always last, you were always finishing last. Was this by intention, or did this just happen? Did you really, what I want to ask is, did you say, I have 48 hours, I use 48 hours, doesn't matter if I'm last or not? Or?
Right. No, good question. No, I think if I finish, if it was 48 hours and I finish in 30, I would be super happy with that.
Okay.
But I just know I have a certain pace going up, I have a certain pace going down, and I run a 4:30 maximum 5 minute per kilometer pace on the flat.
Yeah.
So in no way am I competition level when it comes to the elites. When I mean, not even in the top 10%. These trail runners, nowhere near. You look at when they finish, they're finishing UTMB in, I don't know, 20 something hours
now below.
There you go. Like, never in my, maybe even in, even to my best marathon time is 3:15. I can get to a sub 3 hours, but the level of effort and training that I need to do for it doesn't excite me. To go to, let's say, to run a marathon in 2 hours and 30 minutes is a good example. I will never do it in this lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
I accept it. Doesn't interest me either.
But you can run a marathon 3 times in a row.
Non-stop. Correct.
And that's the difference. I mean, that's what I think is the key aspect, because...
You touched on a really good point, and here's a good analogy on this, actually. Jonas Deichmann is a good example.
Of course.
Right?
He just did the first triathlon, for... How many days? I don't know.
110 or 120. Crazy.
On the original track of the
Challenge
Tennis Roth.
So here's a good example.
My hometown area.
I love it. Roth is nice. I've never done that. So I think this is a good example, actually. I think the question here is, can I do it, and do I have the desire? So can I do what he did? 100%. As we're sitting here, the three of us, I can tell you 100%, I can do 150 days doing what he did.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have the desire to do it.
Okay.
The same way is, you know, some people who are probably extremely good backyard ultra runners, they have the desire to go 80, 90, 100 hours. Or they can do it, but they don't have the desire. I think you need to marry the both together.
Yeah.
The same with Utterberg. Yeah. It's a challenge, But even if you can do it, do you have the desire? Yeah. Two different things.
There's a very good saying a trainer of my younger boy did actually say one time. And he said, there are some people that have the desire, but not the capability. Some people have the capability, but not the desire. But the winners are the ones that had both of them.
Correct.
So I think that's touching exactly what you said, right?
Spot on.
Yeah. I would also like to add, I think what I now heard is on the one side is the motivation, the desire, you said, that's mm-hmm. important. And the other side, also kind of a realistic view on the topic. So mm-hmm. you know what you can do. It's not only about desire and preferences you have, but it's also on the capability and know where I'm good in. And there you can push. And I think you managed that. You realized where I am good at, what is not good for me because of my body stats or whatever you said. You don't like to run downhills, mm-hmm. going up is not so easy. So you know you can get better, but the invest is quite heavy mm-hmm. and don't make fun. But I know there's kind of formats which I can be really tough and really good, mm-hmm. and there I push.
Correct. And it comes with time. The more events you do, the more races you do, the more you train,
the
you
more
realize
experience you get.
More experience you get, you realize what works for you and what doesn't work for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. And I mean, nobody and not everybody needs to compete every race. I mean, there are different formats for a reason. And
so, but good to see that we have Carsten Trilling again in the show, even if he's not part of it. Like,
everybody does.
And Carsten Trilling is the trigger point that Nima starts to get podium places and pushing hard into the background.
So, I bet he's smiling as he listens to this.
Thank you, Carsten. Great work you did. Before we jump, I think we go further in our agenda. Before we jump to the Everesting, because that's the main topic we're talking today about, I think now it fits quite good because tomorrow we have another event. It's also mm-hmm. a backyard event. It's the big satellite world championships. You will run for the Swiss team. It starts tomorrow at 2 o'clock at Jegenstorf. Mm-hmm. And now we are doing today the podcast. So perhaps tell us something. did you prepare? And perhaps let's start with an explanation. I think backyards we already explained in our stories. It's like the 6.7 kilometer loop you do every hour. You need to start every hour a new loop. And the last man standing is a winner. And the second is the assist. Correct. And all the others have a DNF. But the question is, what's this big satellite world championships? So please give us some explanation,
so
Nima.
You have... to kind of summarize it, you have 63 countries all competing at exactly the same time.
Over the whole world.
Exactly. So for us, it's 2 o'clock in the 2 o'clock in the afternoon. The same as for France and Belgium and Austria. But then you have the US, they start at 7 a.m. 7 a.m. And then the UK is obviously starting at 1 p.m. Local time for them. So everyone starts at the same time. 63 of the countries. What makes up the team, every country gets 15 runners. And they are the best runners in the country in terms of laps that they've done racing for their country. So in this case, it's Switzerland.
And you don't need to be Swiss. You just need to...
No, you need to live in Switzerland. You need to have done a race, a backyard, not just in Switzerland, but in any other country representing Switzerland in the last 2 years.
Okay.
So I think for me, it's... I found a 55 yards or laps, and that was done at Suffolk Backyard Ultra early on the 1st of June. I think Matteo is 60. He holds the current Swiss record at 62. So we all run at the same time. You win the country, every lap counts as 1 point. So if 15 runners won one lap, that's 1 point. That's 15 points, sorry. That's 15 points. Correct. We do two laps and it's still 15, that's 30 points. You win the country if you have the most number of points at the end of it.
So you need to have a lot of good runners.
You need a lot of good runners.
To make a lot of points per round.
To make a lot of points. So you like the Australia, UK are usually up there. Japan is also up there. Germany as well, Belgium. And then you have the DACH countries as well, the smaller countries as well that do their part. There's a last man standing. And then the top 50 countries who win, whoever's the last man standing gets a golden ticket to Tennessee for the individual world championships in 2025. There's an additional 25 tickets that go to everyone who's on the at-large list. And what does that actually mean? So you've got 50 that actually win. So if even if you win and if you're a country that wins at 25 hours, it's not enough to get you to the US. So you're
Of course,
out.
You're not part of the 50
best. You're not part of the best 50 countries. Then you have 75 that's on the at-large list. What does the at-large list mean? Is it means that they take the top 25 runners who have done the most yards. So in this case, probably the at-large list will start at 80 and finish at 75 or 70. And they offer them an invitation to go to Tennessee next year. So in the likes of for this event that's kicking off tomorrow at 2 p.m. in Jagensdorf, if, let's say, 5 of the 15 runners go to 80 hours, that's pretty much a guaranteed spot to go to the U.S. next year. Mm-hmm. However, if the winners at 50 or 55 or 60, then the at-large list, there won't be an at-large list. Only one of us will go to the U.S. Next year.
So the key is having lots of good runners to achieve lots of rounds, and then probably you get a place next year.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And it's always, again, we've got the perfect weather for Jagensdorf, and we've got an opportunity to really
perfect
go far.
Guys, good runners. I think it's also kind of this backyard story is also, you can be a really good backyard runner, but if you don't have a strong competitors in that race, you will not achieve a great result because you're only allowed to run one last rep, let alone.
Correct.
So it depends on all the other competitors to really bring up these big amount of rounds. Huh?
Actually, I did never realize that.
That's important to
that's,
know.
That's the important.
So you can be a winner with 24 rounds because you have not a strong competitors
absolutely.
Around you, but you're not allowed to run as long as you want. Then you do one lap and then it's over. Huh?
Correct. Yeah. Yeah.
So
exactly.
Which means, on the other hand, if you want to be on the podium, just don't run against Nima.
Yeah, look, I will say this, going into tomorrow,
you need to set more ambitious goals. Then
that's
run against
Nima,
then you have really a good result.
But jokes aside, look, I'm looking forward to tomorrow, but there's, like you said, there's, I think, the more runners you have, there's safety in numbers, the more the team kind of push you a little bit.
Yeah, of course.
And it's a backyard. I've DNF'd twice at a backyard myself, so I know that in my head I want to go 80, 90, 100 hours. How I'm gonna do on the day is a completely different scenario. You don't know.
Yeah.
Anything can happen.
So yeah, I mean, a lot of factors plays into this game, right?
Right.
I mean, your body and everything, like.
Hopefully, the next podcast you do, you can say that Nima won, but we'll see.
Yeah.
Okay. we're looking forward.
I cross fingers for you. I cross fingers also for Carsten, of course, because he's also part of the team. But now we know the format and how is it, what goals you have. I think goals are clear because you want to have a really good result as a Swiss team and you want to qualify for Tennessee. What are you doing today as last preparation to be quite on top for tomorrow?
So
are there any special Nima lunch deals or special tricks?
We know already one thing.
We know.
We don't tell here, but we know one thing.
That's true. So no, it's meat, carbs, pasta, rice, Coca-Cola, lots of it. Probably 3 or 4 liters of Coca-Cola today.
So a lot of carbs pushing into
just,
your body.
Yeah, just also get the stomach slightly bigger and a little bit ready. And then I'll probably do a sauna session. Go to the sauna, go to the plunge pool, early night, maybe sleep around 9, 10 o'clock. Basically put the nutrition in the car, the clothes in the car, and that's it.
I think the advantage is it's not your first backyard, so you have a lot of experience now and you know what you need, and you have kind of a pack list already in your...
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Not like you need to think about a lot of things, you know I need that, it's kind of a routine already.
Correct, yeah, you don't need to stress so much. I think the most important is that I arrive on time tomorrow and just take it easy. But again, the hard work has been done for training-wise. I have done some bike rides this week and... If you haven't done enough, no amount of training is going to get you ready in 2 or 3 weeks. What's done is done now. You know, you don't need to do anything else. Now you just need to hope that we go far.
Any team tactics?
That we work together, really. I think for me, it's like it's also hard to say what does working together actually mean. Mm-hmm. But working together really means
pushing you together, talking you, helping you on the
correct. But it goes beyond that. It's also support crews coming together and helping each other out. I need a couple of gels. Do you have any honey? And I've said this after my first backyard. I've now done 8 of them, or this will be my 8th. I remain by what I said, which is running 6.7K is the easiest part. It's the support network that you have that feed you, that clean you, that bathe you, that give you your nutrition. That's where the key is. Mm-hmm. If you get that right, running 6.7K, whether it takes you 40 minutes or 50 minutes, is enough. It's what happens in between the lap that's important, which is sleep, rest, bathroom break. That's the key. That's the piece. If you get that right, you can essentially have a runner out there forever.
That's super. That's cool. Fantastic.
Yeah, cool. I hope so. Huh?
I cross fingers.
And no, prayers. I appreciate it.
This podcast show today will be released Wednesday as usual. And we are today at Friday. Saturday, the backyard will start. And perhaps when the episode comes out, you are still running.
I hope so.
That would be on Wednesday, so that would, and then you would be happy if you're still.
That's a dream.
Everybody who is listening now to the episode on Wednesday, please go to the website of the Satellites World Championship. We will put that in our description and push virtually for Nima and the Swiss team.
Yeah, that's
super. Very cool.
Cool. I think let's move to the Everesting, because that was a really great topic,
the never-ending story of Utliberg, bubble.
I need just to repeat some stats before we go into that. Everybody is on the same course. I already mentioned it in the introduction we did in the beginning, but just because we are here together now, it was from the 21st of August until Saturday the 31st of August, 10 days. You did 148 times the Uetliberg loop, so up the Uetli and down. You managed to achieve 627 kilometers overall with 55,000 meters of elevation gain.
Mm-hmm.
And that's unbelievable stats.
Insane, absolutely.
And you never left Zurich.
You never left Zurich.
So that's also great. So let's the first question, how did you do that? How did you manage to do that? And not only the running part, so because you had 10 days, you need to have the time for that, you need to prepare that. Yeah. So how did you start to think about this project?
So
when did you start thinking about this project? I think that's...
So it was probably worth noting, 2 years prior, I broke the Everesting world record by bike. And that was when I was living in Geneva, and I essentially went up and down a mountain, and it was in March, so it was winter. I think it was 57 times, let's say 60 times, and that gave me 40,000 meters of climbing over 114 hours. So I did that, and then I moved to Zurich. The closest mountain to do the same here on the bike for me would be the Etzel on road. And logistically, to kind of get a car there and the infrastructure to set up wasn't so easy. So I think earlier this year, maybe I think it was January, February, I had the idea that actually I can probably Everest the Utliberg. Let's see what it was like. And I think we did that in March or April when the Ex-Utli event happened. And
so just to explain, Ex-Utli is not a club, it's a name for some people that have the same idea and the same interests.
Correct. So a number of us were going up Utliberg and we were like, okay, well, with this, why don't we build a bit of a community around it?
Yeah.
And we start off with, you know, 5 times Utliberg and 10 times Utliberg, and kind of, you know, we met at Albert's Gutli at the bottom of Utliberg, and you know, I think there was, when we did it 5 times, there was 20 people, 10 times there were 30 people. We're like, okay, there's a lot of crazy people that like to do repeats. and go up and down. You're not the only one. So sounds good. How about we try Everesting it? And at the time, the most elevation gain ever done in Switzerland by anyone on, I think on the run was 12,000 meters or 10,000 meters. So almost nothing. The Everesting event was a success. A number of people did the Everesting event. And prior to this, I already had the idea that I can break the Everesting world record. If I was to do it in Switzerland, where would it be? Closest mountain, Utliberg. Problem you have with Utliberg is Lettenenweg is super steep. Mm-hmm. So for anyone, I always say that for any to truly experience what this world record attempt was, you had to really be there. Mm-hmm. And you had to do one lap to understand the magnitude of how steep it is, yeah. And also how brutal the descent was. Because by saying you did
that, that's the main difference between making it by bike, because on the bike you just sit. I mean,
very true.
I know it's oversimplified, but you just sit down and you drive down.
There's no energy expenditure because you're free pedaling, and then you get to the bottom, and then you go on the lowest gear and you pedal again.
Exactly. But if you're running down, you have always this.
You have more impact than going up, I would say.
Exactly. No? And especially if it's steep like the Lettenenweg, like you said.
Yeah. And I think that's you touched on a good point, because I think this is probably worth noting. The rules of Everesting are somewhat clear. On the run, you can do it supported or unsupported. Supported simply means this, that if I climb to the top, because only the climb matters, I can descend back I can call the rega, I can get on a bike, I can call a helicopter, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, yeah, correct. Yeah, yeah. Go down.
Or you do it unsupported. Unsupported means you have to make your own way up, have to run down. Yeah. And this event was to do it unsupported. Right? Because the weight down was so steep, we got approval from Everest.cc, so a guy called Andy Van Bergen who runs it, him and his team, that, look, this is our loop. Does he approve it? What's the elevation? So we know what it is for one. And I think it was 365 or 370. Then we said, if it rains, to go up that steep way, it's muddy, it's too difficult. So what do we do? Can we change the route if it gets muddy or there's an accident or a tree falls down, and the tree apparently did fall down on one of the days. And we got approval to do that. So we had plan A and a plan B. And the plan B was basically we take the stairs up and then come back down the turn, okay. Which is why I think it was a few days into the event. We started, I think, on a Wednesday or the Tuesday. I can't even remember anymore. But on the Saturday, it rained for a few hours, and we had to change the route for a couple of days because it was just you couldn't even climb it anymore. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the how, I knew I could do it. Back to the whole desire and the can aspect of it. But in terms of what did the how of it was planning the route, knowing what we're going to do, how we're going to do it. And then putting together a small little team and then coming up and saying, look, I've got this idea. The idea is to break the Everesting world record by run. Mm-hmm. So initially, when we started, we said that the run world record was set at 42,000 meters. We can break that. It's going to take X amount of days. As the event started progressing and we started getting closer to the date, I came up with the idea of, guys, why don't, rather than break the Everesting world record run, why don't we break the overall Everesting world record, which was 92,000 meters by bike?
This would mean 257 times up the Utliberg.
Correct.
Which 10 was times Everesting.
Correct. No one disapproved of the idea, but they were like, okay, fine, let's do that. Two different categories, run and bike, but it doesn't matter. An overall world record versus a world record on a run, for me, always sounds a little bit better. As to why that didn't happen and the rest of it, we can go into later.
Yeah.
But to answer the how is you put together a team, you have an idea how long one lap takes you, you think about how long each break is going to be, and then you gradually work towards that date. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you just train. And training, you don't need to do 2 times Everest to know that you can do a world record. I think at some point, everything becomes, you get a feel for it.
It gets obvious, right? Because you get a feeling of your body.
You know your body.
Yeah.
And I think there reaches a certain point. So, and I'll use maybe Iger as a good example. Iger 51 to Iger 101 for me is a big jump. But I think when you do 101 and you probably jump to 250, that jump is a little bit more easier because the pain and the feeling that you experience in 101 it's kind of relative to 250. You're not going to get that much pain more, so to speak, in terms of fatigue in the legs and fatigue in the mind.
Yeah, you have some different challenges, I would say, but...
Maybe more on the nutrition and actually the rest.
Yeah, but when I hear you, so I think the most challenging part is really to plan the whole, procedure then. Mm-hmm. So like, I need to have a car somewhere, I need a place where I can rest. Also, I would never thought about to discuss this plan B route, but this was also that you checked that beforehand, you get the permission that
we used the parking space of the tennis club, and that only got approved like 2 days before the event.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so it was. I think they went to the president of the organization and he approved it, but prior to that...
What would you have done if they disapproved it?
Yeah, of course, we would have, because we had a big camper van. We could have parked it on a blue zone, but the camper van is so much bigger and... It's just additional logistics. The benefit you had of Utliberg was you had a toilet at the bottom, you had a toilet at the tennis club, you had a water fountain at the bottom. Again, you're not going to get, I think, the perfect climb and descent would have been Etzel, on the road. Because you stay on the road, you come down on the road. The problem you have, people in Zurich can't support so much, so the community aspect was quite big. Mm-hmm. And we saw that in how many people that turned up. How people would have still turned up at Etzel, but probably not as frequently. You didn't have so much access to stuff. I live in Zurich. I don't live in Etzel.
That's an interesting point, because we did write this down already. Yeah. How important was the community support for you? I know at one point, I don't know, I don't think you told me, but anyone told me. I think Christian, it was Christian, he told me, Nima just said, now just after 3 or 4 days, he starts to understand how important this event is, not just for him, but for the whole community, right? Yeah. Is this correct?
No, absolutely. I think we had a tracker, and through the ex-Utli website that Andrea had created, there was kind of outreach out to the kind of community, runners, people knew what was going on. It's good and it's bad. It's, like I said, after 24 hours, I realized that actually I have no choice but to finish. I have no choice but to continue because the pressure was on because so many people turned up.
The expectations have been there.
Within 24 hours, I mean, I think I came out at 11 o'clock and there was 8 people outside of the camper van wanting to go for a run. I'm like, oh, interesting, okay. And at that point, I hadn't even done one Everest. Okay. I was so in the early stages of it. So, and always the beginning of these challenges are the hardest because it just takes such a long time. You're literally doing 360 meters plus 360 meters plus 360. Oh, I'm now at 1,000 meters. So it takes such a long time. But where the community is positive is they're there. And they're there to help you in whatever way they can. Some want to just walk with you. Some want to talk with you. Some there to cook for you, support you. That is a nice feeling to be there and to have people running with you. I mean, you can't beat that. That you really sense. And I always say, through sport, you find people's best side comes out. Mm-hmm. When people want to support in sport, people's best side. Or you always see people's best side when it comes to sport. The negative side of the community, and this was also the positive side. So sometimes I would go into the camper van and I want to sit there for 15 minutes. But in my head also, I'm also thinking these guys are waiting to run with me. So I'll reduce 15 minutes to 5 minutes or 10 minutes. So,
okay.
Right? Yeah. Because they will wait for 15 minutes. But at the same time, I don't want to keep them waiting. So I'll reduce it to 5 minutes and then we'll do another lap together. Obviously, in the night, it's a lot harder. So 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning is usually the hardest hours to be out there. Not so many people came to support. For obvious reasons, people have to work the next day and the rest of it. The hard part about the community aspect of it is, so I think one lap I did from 5 a.m. to 11 p.m. I think it was the day of my birth, 28th of August, 5 a.m. to 11 p.m. And I think it was the day we actually broke the world record. And not a single lap was I alone. Mm-hmm. Not a single lap.
I was also there.
That's the day you came as well. And I think you came as well.
As well, yeah.
You brought some cake and came. Stuff to make some birthday party for you.
Yeah, I remember you sang it too. No, I remember that. So the downside of it is sometimes you want to be alone.
Yeah,
that would be my question. Sometimes you want to be by your own, no?
And I think if I told everyone, guys, look, I'm gonna do a couple of laps on my own. People would have respected it. At the same time, I didn't feel like doing that.
Yeah, I can understand.
You know, it's you kind of ride through it. It's okay, it's fine. But yeah, some laps you want to be alone. But like I said, when an event is probably of this magnitude, people want to be part of it. They're there for you. And you just ride with it. And then, yeah, sure, you get a couple of hours on your own outfit. You can't pick and choose everything. You're not going to have the perfect scenario ever.
I think it's also important for the community. Then they can talk about that. They have a story to tell.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And that also,
I was there. I was with
that
him.
Also transfers the whole story and the motivation and the passion for that. I think that's important for these.
I understood that when my wife... This was very interesting. Very
now you
interesting.
Understand your wife.
No. Well, I never understand. No, I love you. I love
in
you.
In German, dear. Ganz dünnes Eis. Sorry.
No, what she it was the day when I was deciding to run to your last lap.
Right.
And then my wife was talking to our boys, and she was like, I'm going to support my husband, of course, because it's like 40K to Zurich. But when we are there, we see Nima. And this guy's just about to break the record. And she was telling my boys, like, you can be part of that. You can now be part of an event when someone breaks a world record. And at this time, I understood what magnitude this event had, not just for you, but for everyone. It's like, hey, this is a world record. It's not just he did run some rounds around Deutlibeck, right? Yeah.
No, and I think that touches on a nice point. So when you talk about the community and their involvement, it's like I tie that into kind of what do you do when you want to quit? So some laps are not easy.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think I... At no point did I ever think about quitting, ever.
Okay.
Oh, really?
Not once. However... I did at times just kind of feel like, and I realized this probably at like 120, which is, oh wow, this is quite difficult. Like this is what we are. Then it's like, why are you even doing this? This is such a stupid idea. I think I read that a little bit at the beginning, but more towards the end. But as the event went, it became very clear that I wasn't coming off Utliberg until the record was done. And it wasn't even about my record anymore. It was just more about, okay, you've come up with the idea, great, we're going to make sure you execute on it. But I felt a lot of pressure there, right? Because I also know from previous experience, which is if you, and it's technical, so if you twist your ankle or you break something, sure, everyone will understand, but it's not the point.
No.
And which is why on some of the labs, and then we also sent out the post as well, which is to give me some space, because it got to a point, I think at some point I had 15 or 20 runners around me, and some were in front of me, some were next to me, and sure, if they fall, it's fine, because they go home and they recover for the next 3 or 4 days.
But
something happens to me, and I'm going to basically bandage myself up and carry on going up. And that all of that stuff then can turn into infections.
You needed a safe zone and stuff.
You need a safe zone. So
I understand. Fully understandable. Huh?
It was, truly the Utliberg bubble. I mean, I've hallucinated before at races. And usually hallucinations for me, and I use backyards or long-distance trail runs. They have two... If you haven't covered your nutrition properly or your rest for the fatigue aspect of it, you hallucinate. What does hallucination mean? Basic level, I see a twig on the ground and I see it's a snake. Mm-hmm. Or I see a figure in a tree and it looks like a human being. And it's a human being, but it's not. So that's basic level of hallucination happens when you are fatigued.
I know that
or
quite well.
Huh? Right? There's another level, and this is probably new for me, which is, and I experienced it for the first time at Utliberg, I think it was day 7, at like 2 o'clock in the morning, and I could see the city of Zurich, pitch black, and you have absolutely no idea what you're doing on Utliberg, other than the fact that you need to quickly come back down, because you have your friends waiting for you at the camper van, to go on a bike ride.
Oh, really?
But there is no bike. There is no bike ride. You're there to break a world record. And that for me was like such a complicated, it took me such, it's when you forget people's names.
Okay.
Yeah.
People close to you, the support crew, and you forget their names.
That's a sleep deprivation, huh?
Totally. Huh. Your body is just, it's so tired. It's just running on some sort of autopilot. Because the up as well, and the challenge of Utliberg as well, maybe because I cycle more, I don't feel it so much. Going up is easy. It's coming down that's the problem.
Yeah.
So whenever, for those that were actually there and witnessed it, what I would do is, when I was 500 meters from the bottom, there was a bench that I would sit on. Mm-hmm. And I would sit on that bench and I would take my shoes off just to let my feet air, because they were burning so much.
From the breaking.
Always breaking.
Yeah.
But the descent of Latenenberg, that's really what's going to get you. I always said the success of this challenge is not determined on the ascent, it's the descent.
The descent. I did recognize this in fully when I did see you on the descent, and you were sitting down on this bench, and then I did see you did take off your shoes, and I didn't. It was understandable, because everyone who knows descents, he knows it's burned with the time, and you need to let some air to the feet. But you looked very, very strong in every moment when you did do the descent, except for the let's say 100 meters after this bench, because there were some stairs. And I did see you going down these stairs, and then you could, if you really took a look, you saw how exhausted you were, because you did crawl basically down these stairs. You did not walk them down. Yeah. And this was very impressive to see, because you did make such a strong impression all the time.
Yeah.
I did not see you, stumble or whatever.
Yeah.
No way. But in this very moment, I did see this exhaustion in which you were.
No, you're spot on. You're absolutely right, because those stairs were kind of a little bit of savior to take away some of the pain, because at some point you kind of want to just move. You're shifting the pain to different parts of the body, so you're changing the running style. So after 3 days, I started using the stairs more. So as I use the stairs more for another 3 days, then I allow some of the other muscle groups to heal.
Yeah.
So you're spot on.
What was this kind of your tactics? You said, okay, I don't think that you planned before, after 3 days you do this, but probably you said after a while, when I know it's starting to hurt here, I change to...
Correct. It was more, because I hadn't done more than one Everest, I hadn't experienced, so the pain was new. And when the pain was new, for me, it was more of a case of, I've got this pain, what do I now need to do to fix it? Because I'm going to be here for another 7 days. Okay, let's shift the pain somewhere else.
Okay.
And then let that part of the body heal.
Was this kind of part of your experience?
I kind of learned it on the day. It was totally... Okay. That. And that's the thing with Everest, right? It's like, because it's 10 days, sure... I always said, if it rains heavily, I'm not going to do it. It rained a little bit for 1 day, but I think you need to allow some room for not everything is going to go according to plan. And I think that goes not with everything.
I think that's an important point. I think we also had that in our podcast shows already. It's like you need to accept challenges. You need to embrace them, and you need to think about, how can I deal with them now? And it's not the point like, oh, fuck, now something is hurting. I don't know what to do, and it makes me sad because now it's hurting. So accept it and think about what can I do to deal with it. I think that's important, that you be open and that you have a clear mind. Okay, now it hurts. Perhaps I can try that.
It took me probably the first 3 days just to figure out what are the right shoes for me.
Okay. Oh, really?
Yeah. Because I
but you worked on that. Correct. You were looking forward, not like, shit, now I have the problem.
I knew I had 6, 7, 8 pairs of shoes. I was like, okay, these ones are not working. I changed them. Okay, these ones are not working. These ones now work. And I think it was from day four, I kept the same pair of shoes on to the end.
I guess they were the Ultras, right?
Correct, the Ultra Lone Peaks.
The Lone Peaks.
Yeah.
Oh, because I was wondering, how can he do this in the Ultra Lone Peaks? I mean,
perfect, because you have a lot of space and...
A lot of space, but they have basically no dampening. I mean, they're...
Yeah, but you're not so fast.
Yeah, but just on the descents, I mean, I can imagine that you need some shoes with dampening.
Maybe. And that's maybe why I stopped. Maybe I had the wrong shoes, huh? If possible. That's probably, if I had the right shoes, maybe I wouldn't have to stop at that bench every time.
Yeah.
Possible.
Okay.
But I also don't, for me, my training is 90% of my training is on the bike.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually don't do trail running, running so much, so to speak.
I want to come back with one question shortly about the community, and I have another one just for the community. How important was the community support then for you? If there, would you have been able to finish these 148 loops without community support?
Absolutely. What do you think? No, absolutely. I mean, without a doubt. Look, I mean, community and having a group, like running in a group and cycling in a group is great. I love it. I do it probably 2% of the time. I would like to do it more, but the reality is the time I get up to train...
You have to suppress
a slot. It's a slot. No one's going to wake up at 4, 5, 6 o'clock to train with me. The community was great. In fact, what the memories I have, and one of the reasons we probably stopped sooner rather than later, was the community. It's possible that I could have stayed there for 100,000 meters of climbing if I was on my own.
Oh, really?
But there was no point.
Okay.
Right, so the original plan was to do 257 to break 92,000 meters of climbing. And I think what happened was we realized that as it takes long, because each loop will take you anything between 48, let's say 50 minutes to 1 hour. The breaks were originally 5 minutes, then they increased to 10 minutes, then some breaks were even 15 minutes. So everything just extends the longer you're out there. So... I had to make a decision. I think we broke the world record on the 28th, and then we said we carry on. On the 29th, I think by that point we had reached probably 43,000, 44,000 or 45,000 meters of climbing. I spoke to the core crew and I said, look guys, I think, what's your view? I'm thinking that we go until Saturday, I think it was whatever, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And we do one last lap with the group, with the community, and then we call it a day. We announce it, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And they agreed. My rationale and reasoning behind that was, I could have stayed up Utliberg forever. But there's no point. I also would love... It was such a nice setting of the start and the birthday and all of these people coming running that it made sense to finish it at a set time, break the world record as far as we can, so we broke it by another 13,000 meters of climbing, so the gap is big enough, and we end on a high. We did the last lap together, we took some nice pictures, we had some fun, we had a bit of an Aperol at the bottom. Mm. It was a good setting. There's nothing else to prove.
Yeah.
If I got to 100,000, I'm pretty sure I would have been on my own. I mean, maybe not. But my point is this. Come on, people are tired as well, supporting you for 10 days.
Yeah.
Like everyone has a day job. Let people go home and do what they want to do.
Ah, interesting.
There's no point.
That's a very interesting... point of view, actually. I never thought about that, but yeah. I mean, you stopped because of the community, but it was at the best part. I mean,
it was the best part.
You couldn't top it. Actually,
it's the finish that I remember. Let's say I got to 95,000 meters. So what?
Yeah. So it's just numbers.
No. And 95,000 meters, probably without someone there. You just alone, and then
look. And let me. I'll just probably add this closing statement on this. The record now says 55,000 meters. This record one day will be broken, without a doubt. But that's a good thing, right? It's a record for a reason, right? It's a record, and that is probably the why. It's a record. It's there to be broken. Someone will one day break it, whether it's me or someone else. It's just a matter of time.
Mm.
And then you take it from there. You know?
And they also will have a great time then. And a community kind of...
It depends, but it's not for everybody.
Yeah,
because community brings added pressure that not everybody likes. Because if you DNF when you have the community behind you, it also can make you feel a little bit worse. Whereas if you're on your own and you DNF, guess what? You don't even need to post it.
Nobody cares about it.
You don't even need to post it on Strava.
Yeah.
When you... When I think about it, I mean, you did not hide about the fact that you are going to do a world record try at the Uetliberg. I mean, you could read that everywhere, that it pronounced it on Instagram, you could see a website and all this stuff. What would you think would have been the outcome of the whole project without all this publicity? Uh-huh. So, or in other words, would it been better for you if you would just run without anybody and then no. at the end say, hey, I broke the world record?
I think I'm going to talk about my experience in 2022 and the Everest thing on the bike. Mm-hmm. We didn't have so much publicity, like we have a website and Instagram posts mm-hmm. and with the weeks and this. No, there was this one Strava post, this is what's happening, that's it. Mm-hmm. Over a period of time, when people see you up and down a mountain, this crazy person up and down the mountain over 2 or 3 days, people talk to each other. Mm-hmm. So there would have been people up the Uetliberg regardless of any social media.
So you think it would have 100%. Happened anyway?
Maybe not to the extent that it did, because yeah. the tracker added also another element. They could track us. The Utli events that we had with the 5X and the 10X and the Everest added an additional dynamic and flavor. So it would have happened. People would have been there. To this magnitude, probably not. You know, again, logistics-wise, you know, you need a camper van, you need change of clothes, you need lots of food.
So anyone gets it, there's something special that happening
Correct.
In there. Yeah, I understand.
So yeah, it would have been. How can I say?
It would have been different.
It would have been different.
I'm coming to my second question. I wanted to ask. I think that could. Yeah, I think it's a good moment to ask that. You just mentioned your camper van, the food, the sleep. And when I think about your two passions, like backyard running and this Everesting, I have the feeling if you're good at backyard, such an Everesting attempt is not so far away, because you have doing loops, you can rest, you need to take a rest, you go on the next loop. Mm-hmm. What do you think? Is that completely silly what I think now?
No,
or do you think this was also an advantage for you because you're so experienced in backyard running that this kind of Everesting...
100%. It's a transferable skill, yeah. of course, because like you said, it's a backyard loop you need to do in an hour. 4.4K up the Uetliberg takes an hour. A backyard loop, you take 5 to 10 minute break. An Uetliberg loop, you take 5 to 10 minute break.
And I hear that it's...
100%. You have real food in a backyard. You have real food in this. It's the same. Same concept.
But there's no bell.
Yeah, there's no bell. So you kind of manage the... how can I say? You manage your own effort. Agree with that.
Okay.
It was... Yeah, cool. Agree. No, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, thanks. Cool. I think let's move on to the next block. So
exactly.
So when you think about the whole event, what did you learn from that event? Were there kind of new learnings which you want also to tell our audience here? Things you which were new for you, which you would do in a different way?
No. So look, what I would keep is events that generally for me. Last for less than 24 hours, I fuel on gels, solely on gels, that's all I have. But in a backyard and in the Uetliberg challenge, it was exactly the same. I kept the real food from the beginning to the very end, because gels affect your stomach, some people can manage them, not for me. So I had the same food, I kept to the same food, which is porridge, the risotto, the rice, simple, basic, plain, natural food. The one learning for me, which was kind of new, and I think we just touched on this earlier, is there reaches a point in endurance efforts where you reach a pain threshold or barrier, mm-hmm. I want to say. It's like a ceiling. You reach mm-hmm. a pain ceiling, and you never go above that pain ceiling. So you have pain in your foot or your knee, and that pain, let's just say, happened on Uetliberg round 50. Mm-hmm. That same pain, if it does, it will never go higher even after 100 Uetliberg.
It just stay there.
It stays at a ceiling, which for me is a big learning when it comes back to backyards, which is you're not going to experience a pain at a certain threshold, it's mm-hmm. going to stay level. So just carry on. And again, I always say it's what's going to get you in a backyard or an Utliberg challenge or any of these is fatigue. If you can manage the fatigue, and as the race goes longer and longer, the margins become tighter and tighter because you need more rest, your brain is not in the right area, and it's just the willpower that you need to get up and do another loop is really hard. Right? In a Utliberg challenge, is a little bit easier because you manage the time. You're not under time constraint.
You have not this 1 hour hard clock.
Where you're challenged on a backyard is you've come in at 55, you're in a death spiral. Next lap is 56, next lap is 57, next lap is 58, next lap is 59. You've got in 60 seconds, you're not going to sleep. Mm-hmm. There's barely enough time to get some food and go out for a lap. So that's the kind of learning when I think of the Utliberg challenge. But look, I mean, your feet swell after 24, 48 hours. That's normal. Mm-hmm. I did CCC 101, the UTMB race, I think back in 2018. This was shortly after I did that, and then I did UTMB, then I did Tour de Gion, then I stopped my trail running. I have never in my life experienced blisters that bad. And I said to myself, I need to fix this. So I bought a book called Fixing Your Feet. Highly recommend this book to anyone that's a trail runner, anyone. You have to read this book. It's called Fixing Your Feet. I think they're on edition 7. I now tape my feet. So it'll take me an hour to tape my feet. At the Utliberg challenge, I changed every 48 hours. So I retape my feet maybe 4 or 5 times. The way I tape my feet now, I can run 1,000 kilometers. I will not get one blister.
Okay.
Right? Whereas before, doing CCC, I had blisters so bad that for 2 weeks I couldn't even wear shoes. And now I don't get any blister and I run, you know, 5 times the distance.
So it's just about tapering the
I don't think just about taping. But again, everyone is different. So you speak to some ultra runners, they will tell you they never have problems with their feet.
Yeah.
But it also depends on your feet. So for me, my little toe always goes underneath my other toes and it crushes them.
Yeah.
Some people have issues at the back of the kind of balls or the front of their feet. So you need to figure out what works.
Okay.
Chafing is another good example in the groin area. Yeah. What do you do when you chafe? So everything about the Utliberg challenge was the minute you have an issue, and for me it's the ultimate meditation, because you cannot afford to take any risks. The slightest issue under, let's say, chafing of the armpit, chafing of the groin area, issues in the pain in the knee, the slightest issue, if you don't fix it within 5 laps, it's done.
It's done. Did you constantly monitor?
Every second.
So that's the as you said, your meditation comes from the fact that you did monitor yourself and you
all
did
the
listen
time.
Into yourself.
100%.
Right?
It's like the ultimate listening to your body technique, because you're analyzing, how's my headspace? It's not very good. Why not? Am I fatigued? Am I hungry? You know, my feet hurt. Why? Which toe? It sounds like maybe it's opened. Okay, so I changed the sock. I put a blister patch on. Is it hot? Is it cold? Am I wearing too many layers? Am I sweating too much? Am I not sweating too much? So it's a forever analysis.
Constantly analyzing.
Always analysis. That's you're constantly doing that.
Is that something that goes through your life, this analyzing?
Not to
I mean, I'm just know. I'm just trying
yeah,
to find out if I'm always, you know, when I talk to people, I always try to find out if they have some common ground and why there are some people that love endurance sports and why not. Maybe I tried this time with the analyzing type, you know.
Yeah.
So
maybe not so much. I've been told I analyze things in detail before. But I think life has a routine which you don't so much need to analyze so much. You know, you wake up, you shower, you go to work, you do a sport. So you kind of get a feel for how it is. I think the longer, and this is probably why I love endurance events so much, because you're so connected to your body and your mind, and you understand what works and you don't, that it becomes a bit of a play. It becomes a bit of a dance.
Ah, okay. That's...
I just want to, because I'm thinking just about this, you get connected to your body, you really listen to your body, to the sickness, you feel yourself in a complete different way. And there was my question, Can you or are you able to hear music during these kinds of events, or is it like, is it more disconnecting from the body?
No, good question.
Do you really put off everything what can attract attention to other than to the body, or do you really focus on?
No, good question. So I approach the Jütliberg-Chain similar to a backyard. So a backyard, I'm analyzing the body in exactly the same way. Every hour, every minute, I'm
analyzing. I think it's same effort, huh?
When it comes to music, Jütliberg and a backyard was the same. I start with music, and I will probably listen to music for the first 24 hours. At some point, the music just becomes a bit more repetitive, and you just start focusing on the body a little bit. And actually, it's so nice. It's also the level of concentration you need as the fatigue increases is more. So you need to concentrate more on where you put your foot, how you're feeling, your state of mind. And as the longer the event, you also become slower. Everything works slower.
Yeah, of course.
So music, I tend to then switch off and then just...
I feel you.
Yeah.
I feel you.
You don't need it anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, I never used music during my competitions because I always wanted to be connected to my body. I also love to talk to one or the other runners around me.
Right.
I want to feel it, and for me, it's not pushing me in a competition. When I have easy runs for me in my training, I hear some podcasts or hear music. But I experience the same when I'm in a competition. I need this to concentrate also on me, my body, the feeling.
I would say this. I think if you take the beginning and the end of a backyard, the middle part, like the Ex-Utli challenge, sorry, or the Everesting challenge, the middle part, you're essentially talking about life. As life, like what happens in life. And I think in life, you're going through challenges daily, weekly, monthly. Some days you're having good days, some days you're having bad days. Some days you're in a good mood, some days you're in a bad mood. But over time, everything passes. And I think the Jütliberg challenge was exactly a good example of that. Like a backyard. You could be on hour 20 of the Jütliberg challenge and feel great. And on lap 4 hours later, you're in the worst possible state and you're just thinking, what the hell am I doing here? I just want to go home. So, and within the next hour, on the 25th hour, you feel great again. So I think if you, and again, this is probably really important for me, which is, doesn't matter what you're going through, whether it's a good time or a bad time, at some point, everything will pass. And that will change.
And maybe we're getting a little bit philosophical here, but I love it. I really love it. I love the idea, what you just expressed, just said, because... it's like, did this influence your normal life in some aspects? I mean, do you transfer the experiences that you have from these ultra endurance events now back to your life and say, okay, something bad happens, whatever, but I know it's getting better. I know there is one point where I'm feeling better, where it's getting better. Did this help you in life? Generally,
yeah, I don't say it's getting better. I know it will change. I think the answer to that is I think yes. I think look, for me, it's the sport feeds the work and the work feeds the sport. So what I mean by that is the stresses of work, as an example, allows you to compete or do these events because you see how far you can push the mind and the body. When you do the sport, it then feeds back into the good energy, into work. And you see that in daily life, you know. It's like, we have a saying in Iranian, which is the sun always shines behind the clouds, right? So, right? So at some
just
point...
go behind the clouds.
Let's go behind. Yeah, all you need to do is climb high enough. I think like everyone's got a story. I've got my own challenges that I've gone through or go through, and I know it will pass. And you know, you just crack on and you move forward. You know, it's not. I also think it's like life's a bit boring if you're always having a good day.
Yeah, that's...
No, really, yeah.
I think you need to know some things go up and down, that it gets interesting.
It's the same way. You only really learn... Like, yeah, you can learn when you win, but you really, really learn when you lose or you DNF. My biggest learning was when I DNF'd at Biggs last year because of various issues. But I DNF'd at the DNF. But the learning there is... You, when someone is done, they're done. I never knew that. I thought you could run a backyard forever. But if your mind and body just says, I'm done, there is... I used to think you could die on the course. I genuinely used to think that you could go run until you die. That's not true. The body is so smart that once it decides to pull you out of a race, it pulls you out of a race. You will not die. You will not have a heart attack. Nothing's going to happen. You're going to DNF and you're going to go home and you learn. So, no, it's, huge learnings always.
That's very interesting because there are some discussions about this in endurance science, actually, because, they said nobody died because of endurance efforts. It's like your body shuts down before.
Absolutely.
Are there any strategies for you to overcome this? Or do you say, no, I allow my body...
No, I don't think you can. I used to think you could die during an endurance sport.
I used to think.
I disagree now. I don't think you can do that. And I use Biggs last year as an example. I flew out 24 hours later. I was racing. The wrong approach. What I should have done is taken 3 or 4 days off to acclimatize, to the jet lag, and then race. I went to Biggs. I had a stomach issue. My legs then gave in. I had 6 bad hours and I couldn't pull it back and I DNF'd. I have never felt that bad in my life.
Okay.
When I look at Suffolk as an example, and this is the same, Suffolk, I ran 55 hours. I'm proud to say it was a proud DNF because when I look back at it, there was nothing I could physically have done to have finished a lap. It was impossible.
Okay.
But I never experienced that. Because, and that's why when someone tells me in the backyard that they're done and they don't want to do any more laps, I no longer tell someone, do one more.
Ah, you don't do that?
Not anymore.
No. Okay.
Because before it was like, come on, you can do one more.
Yeah, I know. I know what you
but
mean.
But I've been there where I said that I can't do any more. So now I have a different approach from my own learning, which is when someone tells you they are done.
Respected.
They are done. Even if they give you one more, they're only giving it out of respect for Christian. That's it. They're done.
Yeah. Don't you think that this sometimes is as well just an excuse for not continue? Or do you think or how do you distinguish? I mean...
Yeah, that's a good point.
Some people need this, so to speak, kick in the ass.
That's true.
And probably for some of them, it's true. They can't anymore. But how do you differentiate between those two?
Depends on the person.
Okay.
So I'll give you an example. There's someone who's coming tomorrow who I know she's the only one, so I can say she's a she. Mm-hmm. I've had a conversation with her. She said, you can't let me quit. You need to make sure you put me out there. So that's a good example. When she says she's done, she's not done. Maybe she's got a couple more in there.
Okay.
However, we have someone else who's an organizer at a backyard. When he tells you he's done, he is truly done.
Okay.
He will not do another lap.
Okay.
So it's also getting this, but that's a good point. Yeah. Everyone is a little bit different in their approach. Yeah. Some people also want that comfort.
Yeah.
But the backyard is quite brutal in its nature.
Yeah. I think it depends. It depends on the individual. Somebody.
Yeah.
Everyone manages differently, right? It's like after so many laps, it's like some people need a bit of comfort. Some people need someone to tell them, "Look, you're doing a really good job.
Yeah,
keep going."
I'm one of these.
There you go.
I'm one of these. 100%.
So next year,
that's why I ask you.
Because next year, if you do Whitaker, I know what I need to tell you.
And I would say I'm on the other side. When I say I'm done, then I'm really done.
No,
I never said I'm done yet.
I need some.
I finished everything I started, so
really?
That's also my point.
Okay. I need
some Whitaker that holds my hand and touches my hair and says,
"But that's okay." And that's the beauty of it, right? And I think that's the beauty of also human nature and how we are as people. And this is what I love about backyards, which is you have one person who comes in, and if you ever watch Claire Banworth, Rafe is an interesting one. She does a lap in 58, 59 minutes. It worked for her. You have someone else who comes in at 35 minutes, and he has 25 minutes.
Yeah.
Now, they are both equally as good, but they have completely different strategies, okay. completely different nutritional needs. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the beauty of like humans generally, is we're the same. We all have 5 liters of blood in our system, but we're very different. Mm-hmm. What worked for you doesn't work for you.
That's the cool part. I think that's a good point to jump to one next topic. I think the UTBAG topic we can
skip
because we talked about that.
We already talked about that.
But now you already strived some topics about failure. Mm-hmm. And the question is, how do you manage failure or bad times during the runs? Let's start with bad times. There are some situations you just mentioned where it gets really hard. Mm-hmm. So in the beginning it was a little bit hard, then it was a low time, you had a lot of community support at that point. But what do you do to come over that? Do you have kind of a mantra or stuff? So how do you motivate you again?
So for me, it's probably two aspects. The one aspect is knowing that everything will pass. Good times and bad paths will pass. So if I'm having a bad time, it's...
you know it will be better somehow.
Let's just ride it through. I'm sorry, it's the same with relationships and life, right? It's not every day is not a happy day, right? It's like, this is how it is. Let's ride it through, let's see how it goes. The flip side to that is, and is also my mental way of thinking, which is, I'm not going to quit. I'm going to finish. And that's probably a good turning point. Nima Finisher as a Instagram ID is exactly that. I've never finished. I've never quit a race. Like you, you've always finished, like you said. However, I think finishing and just finishing for the sake of finishing gets into your mind to finish. And I use a good example. I know various people who, if they're halfway through a marathon, and let's say they want to run a 3-hour marathon, if they get to the 21K, mm-hmm. and that 21K is 5 minutes slower, they pull out.
Oh, really?
Because they don't want to do it anymore.
Okay, yeah.
So I feel that mindset, and there's sometimes good reasons behind that, and it's okay. But I feel, for me, what's important is finishing. So when it comes to what's my driver, I know I'm not going to win, but I'll finish. I'm okay. So, look, how do I deal with it? But how do I actually deal with failure? So I'll use a DNF as an example. I've DNF'd twice at the backyard. Once was in Biggs last year. It took me probably a good 1 month to get over it. It was not an easy... Although I couldn't do anything about it, I was upset with myself.
Yeah.
The other one was a Suffolk backyard, 55 hours. But it was a proud DNF. It was okay. I did what I could. We had some issues with the crew and things that happened with the nutrition. It was out of my control. I think when it's in your control and you DNF, it's a lot harder.
I think that's the point. So as I understood your minutes before, the reason is on the one side, I could have done it better. More time, acclimatization, blah, blah, blah. And there I did fail. And why did I do these failures? I think this gets hard. But the other DNF was like, I did everything what I can do. It was the best performance I could do. And so I'm proud of it. And so is that the point where you said
absolutely.
That in one case you had really hard time to come over it because of the failures you did?
Correct. Absolutely.
But in the other end, you learn from the failure. So you can take it as a positive impact.
Yeah, I think
it was a good point that I learned how to can improve in the future.
It's the stuff that's in your control and out of your control too. And I think from DNF in and just failure, look, you're not going to win everything. No one ever wins everything. You need some losses, and I think the losses do make you tough. And I think the success of how well you do it at a race is highly dependent and correlated to how quickly you recover in between. So you run 21K today. If you're able to recover quick, you can run another 21 or 22K tomorrow, no problem. Your ability to go from failure, fall down, and get back up will determine how successful you are. Also,
it's basically the same. How fast you recover from your failure.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's probably something you need to learn as well. I mean, that's something probably comes with the time, that you accept that you are not perfect. You can't win every race. You sometimes lose races, and you need to accept this fact and then recover from that as quick as possible to get up to the next.
Yeah, I think one important point, if I can continue on that, is the ability to reflect on the things what happened before in a clear, structured way. Mm. So mm-hmm. be open. Don't search for any reasons why it didn't work out well. So be realistic and try really to figure out what can I improve, what was not working good. Some more people say it was because of that. Like then it doesn't work.
I love that. That's because that's the German mentality approach coming out, which I love, right? The chronological order coming through. But no, I think you're right. I think you want to, because it's easy to blame.
Yeah.
And I think you need to shift blame. You need to shift blame and say, okay, what has happened? What are the facts? How do I fix it? How do I move on?
That's the point.
That's it.
Sounds easy, but...
You look at my first backyard with one spare t-shirt, no extra shoes, and a backpack, no chair. And you look at when I turn up to a backyard now, there are two different backyards. Mm. One turns up with a tent, a chair, a bed, you know, 20 liters of Coke. And the other one was, what am I doing here? Two different backyards.
Yeah. That's the evolution of Lima. But you just want to come back to the Everest thing now.
Mm-hmm.
Just because
I think we have the same question.
Yeah, really? Okay, cool. In the beginning, you said first you planned these running Everesting record. Yeah. And then there was kind of the idea, hey, let's do the overall record. It's only 257 rounds up, 10 times Everesting, with only over 92,000 meters of elevation gain. So you started on day one also with that goal in your mind.
Correct.
And then there was a point in the race where you said, I will not do it. I will not achieve it. Did it feel like a failure for you?
Absolutely not. No.
Okay.
Of course. Look,
what happened in your mind?
So 28th of August, we broke the Everesting world record.
Yes.
And we were planning to finish 3 days later. To get to 3 days later, I already knew that that would push us at around 55, between 55 and 60. I already knew in order to break the 92,000, I had to be out there for another 10 days. Probably 8 days, because again, the margins get tighter, the rest break become more.
Take longer,
I said to myself, and we agreed with the crew, which is, we've achieved what we've come here to achieve. It's not a failure. They're two different categories. I could have stayed out there longer. There's no doubt about that. But again, the community was on a high, the support crew was on a high. It's nice to finish at a certain date. And we call the project the close.
Okay.
The Everesting World Record by bike is not a... When I say it's not a difficult record, it's a record that's going to require me to be out there for, again, probably 7, 8, 9 days.
Yeah.
But it's a bike record.
Okay.
Two different.
So it was also not the main goal at the beginning. It was like...
No, it wasn't.
Let's take it as extended goal, as stretch goal somehow.
Absolutely.
But if not, okay.
No, the original idea was the run. When we started, so day one, when we started, I said... Let's go for the world record. But I also didn't realize that as the days go longer and longer, mm-hmm. got longer and longer, and it takes me longer to change my shoes and to eat and to digest the food, I realized that this project is actually it's a different project. It's a biking project. It's not a running project.
Mm-hmm.
But it made sense to stop. I mean, look, it was a nice...
Not blaming from my side. Yeah. So I just wanted to know if there was kind of a fight in you...
No, not at all.
...to
not
decide all. To that, okay.
No, not at all.
Okay.
And for me, it was a success, you know, on all fronts.
Yeah, of course. Great success. Not only for you.
I'm happy with the result.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. talking about success or not successful in this... In this context, it's the wrong approach, I guess. No, it was just interesting to know, because if this would have been an overall goal from the beginning on, then it probably would have been a so-called DNF, and it would be interesting for you to know how you deal with it. But as you said, it was a decision at the beginning to extend it, and correct. Then it's absolutely... understandable to cut that down at one point and say, okay, it's not getting better than this, so absolutely. Let's stop it.
In our business, we always talk about stretch goals in that case, and stretch goals in the It does not often happen that we really reach such goals. So
yeah, that was.
Let's take it as a. As a simple stretch goal, and perhaps next time, huh?
On the bike, yeah, perhaps next time. No.
Continue? Do we continue
with the next? I think so. Yeah, I'm just trying to think about so many things. I mean, 1 million more questions I could ask about all this, but it's okay. Let's move on to the next topic. We never stop.
So we come a little bit to the topic of what drives you. Or also the, we just discussed it in the beginning, the big why is not the, it's not for you really relevant, you told us beforehand, but I just want to know, why are you doing that in the end?
So I love sport.
You love sport?
I love sport. And what I went on a bike ride a couple of days ago to Taper, and I'm at my happiest place when I'm on my bike riding. Whether I'm riding with someone or I'm on my own, it's like I can't put into words how grateful and happy I am when I get on that bike and I go around the lake or I climb the mountain. It's like my happiest place.
And guys, and to our listeners now, if you would see his bike, you would totally understand that.
But I'm at a stage in my life where I like the performance. I don't ride for the sake of riding. So I'm riding whatever. I use Tour or Race Across Switzerland. I'm riding to perform and to do well. So
you also did win this year the Tour 500, huh?
Yeah, I got lucky to win that.
Yeah, lucky. Lucky sounds like you had luck.
Maybe. But I also ran Race Across Switzerland, which was and won that one, which was actually 4 days before the Everesting Challenge.
Oh, which sets the Everesting in, again, in a total different context.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. So
two weeks before, right?
Yeah, no, it was actually 4 days before.
4 days before you did finish.
Yeah, so I did the Race Across Switzerland. So the Tour 500, I think it was 8,000 meters of climbing, I won in July. And then 4 days before the Everesting Challenge, I cycled the Race Across Switzerland for 500 and I think 5K or 15K with 8,000 meters of climbing. And I won that, I think, with 19 hours. What drives me is the performance aspect, which is kind of where I am in my life, which is I want to perform, and I perform through the endurance events. And what drives me as well is to do well. And I give you an example. So how I prepare for the big or the backyard, which I have tomorrow. 90-95% of all of my training is on the bike. You don't need to be a runner to run a backyard. You need to be good at endurance and also understand how you manage failure,
and
which
manage
is what
your
we
body.
Talked about, and manage your body.
Manage, monitor your body, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what drives me is to compete, if that means competing probably, you know, 2, 3, 4 times a year. I'm an absolute failure when it comes to 50K or crit racing or 100K racing. No point. It's a bit dangerous. 2, I the heart rate's too high.
A bit dangerous?
Yeah, because there it's too many riders, very compact.
That's what you meant.
Yeah,
okay.
So it's a little bit like even UTMB for me is just one up. Too many runners all condensed, whereas Tour de Gion is kind of... You still have a lot of runners, but everyone's really spread out.
Yeah.
Where I've come to realize what I'm good at is the endurance stuff.
Yeah.
And that's the stuff that kind of drives me every day. Huh? It's just pushing and seeing how far I can push. So I have, you know, I want to go around Lake Zurich, Zurichsee, Obersee as the next project 10 times nonstop.
Mm-hmm.
Which is 920 kilometers. I have the desire to do it and the want to do it. I just need to find the date.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's so many cool challenges that I have planned. It's just a matter of time of executing them and finding the right weather and temperature. Because when you plan an event like that, it also, you know, you're riding. But you're riding at 3 o'clock in the morning. 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning is in October, November. it's probably 0 degrees or 4 degrees, so it's cold.
Yeah, of course.
You've got to manage all of that, but the driver is really the endurance stuff.
Yeah. Mm. Oh, interesting. I think nothing to add here.
No, absolutely not. That's
great.
It's really fascinating to hear that. Yeah. So we know your next project, 10 times around.
Yeah, the next, there's many projects. I mean, now, obviously, after the backyard, I have no more races this year, which will be great. So I'm going to spend more time on the bike. I want to cycle from Zurich to Alicante, which I think is like 1,700, 1,800
Get
kilometers.
Get some good drinks there and party.
You know, I did do this one time with a car, so I know what to expect.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. I just want to experience the road.
I would never do it by car again, but...
What? By bike.
But, well, it sounds interesting, but non-stop, right? You said
yeah,
non-stop.
I want to run from Zurich to... Zurich to Geneva, I have to run, uh-huh. And then one other challenge. I actually asked ChatGPT to create me a GPX route going all around Switzerland as one continuous ride.
Okay.
So I'm still trying to figure that out, but that's another project I want to do.
Oh.
There's so many projects and records to be broken and to do, and it's just finding the time. And
so I see you're really an creative guy.
I mean, you need a project. I think
to create your own projects, and you're not the guy looking for established competition races. And I want to go there. You just think about your own projects.
You find your competition.
And try to find your.
No, look. I found two things that I'm good at. Probably one is the backyard. Two is long distance events.
Yeah.
Cycling events.
Yeah.
The next step is. Again, for 2025, it's going to be, let's see what's on the calendar, race-wise. If not, I create, and there's plenty of projects. So right now I'm doing less racing, more project creating, because there's just so much to do. Wow. There's so much to explore.
That's so cool. That's so cool.
Yeah.
Thank you. Cool. I think somehow we need to come to the end.
To an end. Somehow, huh? I really think we could talk about forever, talking about endurance, right?
That is true. We could talk forever.
I think a lot of topics we already covered when I look at my notes.
Absolutely, yeah.
Do you have a last
Actually, I had a question which was very interesting, but I did just forget it. So let's continue. Maybe I remember.
I think the one thing I would say probably to anyone who wants to do these longer events, backyard or just long distance events, is I think it's a progression. So when I look at Everesting or some of these long distance cycling events that I do, it's not like one day from the other Nima decided to run or cycle, you know, 500, 600, 700 kilometers. It's a progression over time, which is you run 10K, you cycle 50K, you cycle 100K, you run 100K. It progresses slowly, and then you're testing the body into what works and what doesn't work. So when people look at the achievement, they look at the achievement at a point in time.
Absolutely.
But what really needs to be looked at is it's actually all of the training and the long hours and the early wake up and the nutrition that goes in between all of this that makes that actually possible.
Someone said, getting the medal at the end of a marathon, or I don't know, it's just about
you just
collect the medals at the marathon. You don't earn them at the marathon. You earn them before. That's
totally.
That's the same.
Yeah, I think Usain Bolt said, what did he say? He goes, racing is the easy part. Training is the hard part.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
Talking about training, that's one interesting question. How does a typical day look for Nima, training-wise? Because if I listen to what you're doing and the achievements you had, there must be an awful amount of training that you do every day.
So I probably, I'm probably cycling between 10 to 15 hours a week. I'll do, if I'm lucky, I'll get 20. But let's say 10 to 15 hours a week. That includes a 4-hour ride on a Saturday, maybe a 4 or 5-hour ride on a Sunday. I'll then do 2 or 3 runs in that week, that's it, and there'll be 10K runs. I have a 10K loop, I'll do 10Ks. So that's 4 activities or 5 activities a week.
Per week, yeah.
What I do, I think, and this is probably what separates it, this is a little bit of a secret, but I'll say it anyway.
Okay.
I go to the gym twice a week, and there's only two activities I do in the gym. I don't do anything else. I go to the gym, I'm there for half an hour, I do these two activities, and when I'm done, I leave. I do squats and I do deadlifts. That's it. So basically the squat is going down, putting the weight on your shoulders and going down, and the deadlift is basically the bar is on the ground and you're essentially lifting it up. The squat is a full body workout. Helps the whole body, reinforces the legs, the back, the shoulders, everything. And the deadlift massively reinforces the back.
Which
back
you
and
the need, core. Especially for cycling. For cycling,
yeah. You need for the cycling, but it also what it helps you in the backyard is it helps you stay upright.
Yeah.
Because after 2 days of running, the body has a tendency to lean forward.
Mm-hmm. So I think I attribute probably where I've succeeded so well, actually, maybe in backyard, is and what helps me go far. I could probably realistically even not run at all, only cycle and do deadlifts and squats, and it'll be sufficient.
Okay, that's interesting.
Deadlifts and squats are, if you incorporate them into your training, you will go far.
I do 4 times a week, kind of body workout, freeletics, and squats are always part of that.
Then you need to do Whittaker next year.
I work with kettlebell also for...
Perfect.
It's also perfect for stability.
Yeah, I think one thing where people, if they overrate running, is they think that in order to do some of these challenges or events, you need to be a runner and you need to run far. And that's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to do marathon weekends. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it helps you understand your body and where fatigue kicks in. But you don't need to run 40 or 50K to run a backyard ultra. Yeah. And we look at a backyard ultra as, wow, they run 700 kilometers. But that's the wrong way of looking at it. They actually only run 6.7 kilometers.
But over and over again.
Over and over and again.
But it's
and
a different impact. Huh? It's completely different sport.
And that's the difference.
Yeah.
Do you plan your training? Do you structure your training in any way? Or do you just...
So I've never had a coach in my life.
Never.
Never had a coach. Maybe because work has never really allowed in terms of timing, schedule and the rest of it. And also, I train. I'm not lazy by nature, so I don't need to worry about late being lazy. But as I've got older, I also don't train when I'm tired.
Mm-hmm.
I train when I feel like it.
Yeah, that's good. Which you means know your body. You know.
I want to train. I want to train 24 hours a day. But if my body says, "Look, for 2 days, I'm not going to let you do anything," I don't do anything. And the reason I don't do anything is back to failure. I've learned the hard way. I've then done something. I've injured myself or got sick, and then I spent 6 months on a bed.
That's very, very good.
I like that approach because it's really like you monitor yourself, you check in with your body, you learn from failure, you adapt your training. So I think that's important to be successful and to be healthy.
But you only learn that also. You can learn from people's success, or you learn from failure or other people's failure too, not just your own. This is one I've learned by my own failure. In that I've been injured enough to know, okay, that's enough. So I haven't been injured for the last 3 years. And I'm happy with it.
Yeah, perfect.
You know?
Wow.
Very interesting.
I also have one last question, sorry. So when you think about we come back to the Everest thing. One last question.
Yeah, absolutely.
What was the one highlight you...
Last lap.
The last lap.
Yeah, absolutely.
Last lap, so...
100%. Last lap. It was great. Everyone was there for the, you know, so many people were there for the birthday. But the last lap was really special for me because, you know, my vision at the beginning, and I remember telling this to the crew, was I would love to see, you know, 15, 20 people all running at night with their headlamps on and we're all doing like a train down. That happened the same way I said, so I would love the vision to, I look back down and there's grown-ups, there's kids. I think Adrian brought his kids and, you know, the kids are going up. Everyone's going up at the same time. And again, that happened. And when you see something happen based on what your vision of it is and it's executed to it, I mean, how could you not be happier? So the last lap for me was super special. And we were so great. We were so lucky with the weather, you know.
So cool too, yeah.
It was
perfect.
It was
the weather was amazing, great. You know. You saw great sunrises and beautiful sunsets, full moon.
And what was very impressive, absolutely, was when you did put your two watches down on the
screen. Yeah, that's true.
We waited for transfer the
data
to Strava.
It's so funny. You know, it took 10 minutes for the watch to save and 2 hours for it to upload to Strava.
What watches did you wear?
I had a I had two watches. On my right hand, I had the Garmin Epix 2, and on the left, I had the Fenix 6X Pro. The 6X Pro was essentially a backup, but every 48 hours, we just charged both of them. 1 hour, they were fully charged.
Oh, really? Yeah. Was enough.
Yeah. It was enough, and then it would get to a 1.5 hour for, because it would get by every 40 hours, it would get to about 28%, 30%, charge it again to 100, and then back on the road.
Yeah, well, that was very impressive then, and I was at one moment I was scared if it.
Me too, right? Because it just kept saying saving. I was like,
there's no way on earth. I didn't try to make a photo, and probably someone else as well. So. Just in case, you have the photo.
It was so crazy.
No, it did teach myself a lot of things. Just going this couple of rounds with you. I mean, I did just join you for, I don't know, 4 or 5 leaps, something like this. But I learned so much from it, and I want to say thank you for myself for making this experience.
No, absolutely.
And having the chance to be part of it as just a small part, but anyway.
No, thank you for coming. Thank you for having me on your show. It's been fun. Sorry it took so long.
No. It was really a pleasure. I could go on for hours, but you have a world championship race tomorrow.
Yeah.
We have some stuff. I need to go to a punk concert this evening. So.
Oh, yeah. So, we want to see photos. Don't forget that, Chris. Don't forget that.
But before we close, really... I think to get a wrap up is quite difficult because there was so much news. I think what was important for me is like this pain sealing story. Mm-hmm. Also knowing that the taping your feet can solve a lot of problems. That's really the tip about how to deal with blisters on your feet. Really important. Real food. I had the same experience on my 250. Gels were not working, but real food was really working all the time. The self-monitoring, it was really interesting to see how you be one with your body and how you start really to check your body all the time and to start to work on mitigation measurements that you don't come into bigger problems. I think that's the key in these long endurance races. And also to get a feeling about how somebody can really good in running stuff when he's not really a runner. So I think really, really interesting input and also the kind of community support, but also the pressure of what community means also for you in that case, because you were also impacted by the community and not always on the good side, because also you had the feeling, I don't want to let them wait so long. Let's go further on. So really, really interesting insights we got here in the interview. So thanks for that, and also for being so open and so honest to us. I think that's
absolutely interesting. It was a great chat, and I think I think sometimes you just also you need to find one, what you're good at. To what you want to do, and also maybe a little bit of belief in yourself, you know.
And focus.
I think the idea of Utliberg timed 148 just sounds crazy already. But I had a belief in myself, and I had a support network of people who believed in me. And I think it goes to anyone who's listening to this, who really thinks about doing any sort of project, which is. If you look at the best times and you want to compete, look at what they've done, build towards it. You can do it, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not a professional, but I think Race Across Switzerland, Tour, some of the backyards, you don't need to be a professional to win this stuff.
Know your skills, know your passion, and
push on. Know what you're good at. Again,
don't try to be anybody.
Know what you're good at.
Look what you are good at.
Totally
perfect.
Focus on yourself.
If somebody wants to follow you, you have an Insta account.
Oh, yeah, Instagram, Nima Finisher.
Nima Finisher. We will link it in the show notes. Is that okay for you?
Yeah, of course.
Of course.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah, I think there was nothing to add to to your last words.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the great food.
Oh yeah, was absolutely perfect.
And thank you for your time.
No, appreciate it, guys. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Cheers, guys. And good luck for tomorrow.
Oh yeah.
Cross fingers for Team Switzerland.
Hopefully you're still talking about it on Wednesday.
Go Nima. You can hear our podcast then on Wednesday.
Everyone's having
now it's Wednesday, Nima. Go on, you still have something to do here.
Everyone's sending me messages on Instagram. We're listening to the podcast now. You're still running.
Why are you not running anymore?
Why did you quit?
Come on, you can do one more. Now we are at this point.
All right.
Thank you guys. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.